Herman.
Hey, I'm going to call to order this meeting of the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources.
I'm going to order the House Committee on Energy and Environment.
Okay, welcome, colleagues. Here we are, back to school briefly. Good to see you all. So we have a lot of informational items on our agenda, but before we get started, we need to adopt committee rules for this interim. So I will open a work session of the Senate committee for the purpose of adopting committee rules. Vice Chair Olson.
Chair Denver, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules.
Senator Olson has moved to adopt the proposed committee rules. Beth, is there anything we need to know about these?
No, Senator. They're basically the same rules we've had before. They've been reorganized a little bit, but basically the same.
Any discussion, colleagues? Is there any objection to our adopting these rules? Seeing none, so ordered. I'll close the Senate work session. And my colleague.
I'll open a work session on the adoption of interim committee rules. Do I have a motion?
Chair Helm, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules.
Representative Johnson moves to adopt the proposed committee rules. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection to adopting the interim committee rules? Seeing none, the rules are adopted, and I'm closing the work session on the adoption of interim committee rules.
Okay, I'm now going to open our information hearings. We have a number of them, colleagues, and nearly all of all of them really overlap the jurisdictions of our two committees, and so it made sense for us to bring these two committees together for this reason. And the first of them has to do with the Clean Energy Jobs work group process. And let me just give a little summary for you of how we got to where we are, and then a sense of where we are, and some hopes for where we're headed. You'll recall that during the session that just ended 2 months ago, we spent a lot of time during that session having information hearings around the question of putting a price on greenhouse gas emissions, and if we're going to do that, what is the best way to do it? You'll recall we heard testimony, information from people from California, from Quebec, from Ontario, from experts of various sorts. We started this off with a report from the Global Warming Commission, where we heard that we are not currently on track to meet our global warming goals for 2050, and it seemed likely that we would not meet those goals if we don't take more aggressive action to curb greenhouse gas emissions. So at the end of the session, Chair Helm and I kind of put together all that we had learned over the course of that session and came up with a bill that was introduced at the very end, Senate Bill 1070, that more or less captured our best thinking from all of that work. And it essentially is what's often called a cap and trade and invest, or just cut to the quick, a cap and invest system that would put a cap on greenhouse gas emissions that would be lined up to take us to our goal by 2050. And that would then require companies to have allowances, to purchase allowances that if they needed to exceed those goals. And this is a system that has been in place now for several years in California. Colleagues, you may know that California just a couple of weeks ago readopted its cap and invest program. It did so in a bipartisan manner with a two-thirds majority, actually, of both chambers. Speaking of chambers, it was endorsed by the California Chamber of Commerce and a number of business organizations who have been pleased with the direction that it has been going. And so our Senate Bill 1070 actually envisions us joining the market that California is part of together currently with Ontario and Quebec. And there are others that are considering joining that that market. Obviously, for a small state like Oregon, it makes sense for us to join a market so that we don't have to reinvent the wheel. Anyway, Senate Bill 1070, as I mentioned, was our best thinking at the time. However, we knew that there remain many unanswered questions. You know, my own sense is that if we do this right, not only would it really benefit our goal of reducing carbon emissions, greenhouse gas emissions, but it would also be a really good thing for Oregon, particularly rural Oregon, if we do this right. If we do it wrong, it can be bad for Oregon. And we don't want that to happen. We want this to be a good thing, to see it spurring renewed investments all over the state. So to get us to the point where we are getting those final unanswered questions answered and making sure that it is doing good things for Oregon, we decided to create a work group process that would bring together legislators, advocates, industry people who could come together and share their wisdom and what they know about how these programs are working in other states, hear their concerns, make sure that we can adapt the program to incorporate their concerns, you know, wherever possible, and move forward in moving this legislation in the next session. So to that end, we have created four work groups. And let me say, colleagues, and for the public, these work groups all have web pages assigned to them. Because of the kind of still somewhat arcane restrictions that we operate under here in the legislature, those web pages can't be part of our committee web pages. We're hoping at some point that work groups can actually have their homes in committee websites. But for now, these pages, you can get to them through my legislative website or Representative Helms' legislative website. They'll look identical. So depending on how you feel, if you feel more Senate ish one day or house-ish, yeah, you'll see the same thing.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
We'll be running a poll just to see who's on front.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
Mr. Chair, I'm on Representative Helms' website, and I'm having, and yours, and having trouble finding the groups.
Well, that's because they're not live yet.
Oh, there you go.
But they will be, as I understand it, any minute. Later today.
Thank you.
Okay. They're designed. They just have not yet gone live.
You just don't have access.
So what you'll find on the website once you get there is the nature of these four work groups and the charges, the questions that these work groups are being asked to, the questions that they're being asked to answer. So Let me just quickly go over the four committees, the four work groups, and then I'll turn it over to Rep. Helm for his comments. So the first one, which actually Rep. Helm is chairing, is the Forest, Agriculture, Fisheries, Rural Communities, and Tribes work group. And this one is really focused on the, you know, how can we design this program so that it it helps those communities adapt to the phenomena that we're already experiencing as a result of warming and ocean acidification, but also how we can use the investments from such a program to boost the economies in those areas, as well as, of course, try to mitigate greenhouse gas emissions. The second group is utilities and transportation, and that is, you know, I think it's kind of self-evident. How can we make this program cohere with the work being done by the PUC and the work that the utilities are doing following up on legislation we passed before, and the same with the transportation sector. How does this program cohere with what we just passed in the last session? Senator Beyer is going to be chairing this committee. The third committee is what we call the Regulated Entities Work Group, and that deals with those companies that, within the parlance, are known as EITEs, that is, Energy Intensive Trade Exposed. Okay, those industries that are, you know, obviously very important to our state economy, things like pulp and paper, cement, steel, which are energy intensive, and so they are sources of substantial emissions. But if they were to leave the state because of requirements that we put on them, they would probably still be emitting, and we're all vulnerable to that as a planet. So how can we keep them in business, keep them in state, while at the same time helping to get them on a path to become more efficient and reduce their emissions? That's the challenge of the third group, the Regulated Entities Group, which I'll be chairing. The fourth work group is what we're calling the Environmental Justice and Just Transition work group. And that group is looking at, in part, the consequences of the program and making sure that it doesn't have place undue burdens on communities that are already challenged, low-income, rural communities, labor, because there will be some dislocations, some shifts in our industries. How do we make sure that those the workers in those industries get the training, the retraining, the job placement that they need in order to do that, to make that transition in a way that the transition is not on their backs. So the chairs, we have two chairs for this committee, and it's Rep. Marsh and Rep. Hernandez are going to co-chair this committee. And that one will have a number of stakeholders from labor and from communities of color and impacted communities from all over the state. So those are the four work groups. They're going to have their first meeting this Thursday. I know that several of you here at this dais are going to be on these work groups. I just want to remind you all that you are all invited. I think you all received invitations to participate in one or more of these work groups. Really encourage that. Hope that we'll see that happen. So the first set of work groups will meet this Thursday, and there'll be one right after the other. So those of you who are in the audience, you can go to every single one of them. But then subsequent meetings will not be all on the same day. But we have a second set in November, in October, and a third set in November. And then our goal is, as a result of all of that work, to come up with a redraft of Senate Bill 1070 that will be delivered to Legislative Council. I will say Legislative Council is very involved in this process as well, and that should make the final drafting easier. So with that, I'll step back and Rep. Helm, thank you. Comments.
The only thing that I think I'll add to that very good explanation of what we've been doing is that the work that occurs in the work group and the actual 2-hour sessions that we're planning are they're going to be populated by both legislators from both chambers, representatives from the governor's office, representatives from the affected agencies, and then interested stakeholders. And as the plan for the work groups has progressed and become more clear, naturally more and more entities have become interested in the work and want to participate. And I wanted to assure folks that if you do want to participate, all of the work groups are open. They're open forums. Much of the discussion is going to occur between the invited stakeholders, but every meeting will have a chance for anyone who's interested to comment to do so. And the idea is we have to balance getting our work done efficiently with the limited amount of time that we have and trying to get all good ideas and all good concerns on the table. So there will be a chance for that. There will be a chance for discussion along those lines. And I think that is all I'll add at this time.
Okay, and I'll add to that last point that we will also be taking written testimony at all times, and we'll be posting whatever is submitted to us, and it's on an official record, but we want this to be a very public process. So with that, colleagues, questions? Okay, then. Great. Okay, so Beth, was there anything else? No. Okay. All right, then I will close that section and open an informative briefing on Cleaner Air Oregon. And I'll ask Director Whitman to come up, Aaliyah, and Keith Johnson is, yes.
Record. Richard Whitman, Director of the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. Good morning, Senator Dembro, Chair Dembro, and Chair Helm, members of the committee. I have with me today Deputy Director Leah Felden and the Special Advisor to the Director of the Department, Keith Johnson, for the Cleaner Air Oregon Project. We're very happy to give you an update on this important effort that started about 18 months ago with direction from Oregon Governor Brown to the Department of Environmental Quality and the Oregon Health Authority to develop a health-based program to address industrial air toxics. So I want to start out setting a little bit of context for this program. I think we're all aware that there are many sources of air toxics that create health risk, including cars and trucks and diesel emissions, as well as wood stoves and the effects that we've seen very recently from our wildfires throughout the state of Oregon. All of those are sources of air toxics. Industrial air toxics can be significant, particularly in the areas in the immediate vicinity of industrial facilities. And so this program is designed or will be designed to address those localized effects of industrial emissions. At the same time, we're also very aware that poverty is a key determinant of health in this state. And so part of the charge to the agencies in developing this program has also been to develop a program that considers the needs of existing businesses in particular, particularly in parts of our state that are suffering from high levels of poverty. So you may ask why, given everything that we have on our plate, and you just heard about a big piece that we have on our plate, why are we even worried about industrial air toxics? So first of all, our existing systems for regulation do not address the localized impacts of industrial air toxics for the most part. There are gaps in our programs in several respects. First of all, in terms of federal law focuses primarily on area-wide impacts from air quality, not so much localized impacts. There are also certain air toxics that are not regulated under our existing programs. Another thing that is driving this, frankly, is public concern about industrial air toxics. So what is leading to that? What is leading to the public concern about industrial air toxics? Well, the extent of our information about air toxics is improving. There's something called citizen science that some of you may have heard of. MOS studies are one example of that, but there are other types of technology that are developing that allow our citizens to know really directly what is in the air around places where they live and work. So to some degree, this is a problem that has been out there for some period of time, but we simply haven't had the technology to really know about it. That is changing, whether we like it or not. We, our citizens are learning about what is in the air around where they live and work. And one thing that that increased knowledge is driving is a lot of uncertainty. Uncertainty among our citizens, but also uncertainty in our business community. As we see citizen concerns about industrial air toxics, we need a predictable, stable system for addressing those concerns. And that's what Cleaner Air Oregon is about. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Ms. Felden.
Thank you, Director Whitman. Good morning, Co-Chair Dembro and Co-Chair Helm, members of the committees. For the record, my name is Leah Felden. I'm going to tell you a little bit about the engagement activities throughout this process so far. This effort has been characterized by a high degree of community and stakeholder involvement. In the summer of 2016, we convened four technical work groups. We gathered local and national experts who considered key policy issues and reviewed programs in neighboring and other states to help inform what an Oregon program might look like. The intent was to learn from others' efforts to create a program that would work for Oregon. In the summer of 2016, we sponsored Oregon Air Quality 101 and the Air Toxics Permitting in Washington and California webinars, both also available on our website. We also convened four regional public forums in Pendleton, Bend, Medford, and Portland in order to get input from citizens and communities statewide. In the fall of 2016, we convened a 23-member Rules Advisory Committee, a traditional part of the rulemaking process that represented many diverse perspectives. The committee met seven times over the course of the last year. At its most recent meeting in August, the committee met for a day and a half to review draft discussion rules as well as the fiscal impact statement. The advisory committee phase of the rulemaking is now complete, and this marks a milestone in this effort and the transition to broad public engagement through public hearings and additional outreach and the notice and comment period. Now, I want to talk a little bit about what principles have been at the forefront of this program. When Governor Brown directed DEQ and the Oregon Health Authority to reform air toxics regulations, she articulated three guiding principles to the agencies. Number one, that the program be protective of public health. When this program is in place, we will be able to better assure Oregonians that industrial air toxics are being appropriately controlled to protect their health. As Director Whitman mentioned, we know that the biggest threat to health is poverty. This initiative is about striking the right balance between ensuring that people living near industrial facilities are not exposed to an undue burden of risk and ensuring an air toxics permitting program that is both practicable for industry and aligns with health. Number two in the guiding principles, that it is grounded in science. We strike the right balance that I've talked about by ensuring our actions and rules are grounded in solid science and data. Number three, that the program is predictable. Using a science-based approach will lead to a consistent and transparent process for Oregon businesses and the communities in which they operate. The draft discussion rules describe a program that aligns with the governor's principles in a variety of ways, and I'm going to talk to you about some of the key elements of the program that align with those guiding principles. So first, the program is based on assessments of the risk, that's cancer and non-cancer effects posed by a facility's emissions. These assessments use emissions data specific to and provided by the facility. The rules are designed to accommodate emissions data and ambient monitoring data. Industrial facilities will be required to calculate and report the risk posed by their emissions where people live. Another element, the rules, the proposed rules are organized around risk action levels. That's a term of art that we're using in the current discussion draft, meaning that the regulatory responses are triggered when the risk posed by a facility's emissions exceeds certain levels. Facilities regulated under Clean Air Oregon have flexibility in how they assure that their emissions meet the risk action levels. Options might include installing emission control equipment, incorporating pollution prevention, substituting hazardous materials, or altering work practices. This is different than traditional permitting programs that regulate by prescribing certain technologies. If risk from a facility's emissions are already below the risk action levels, there are no additional actions needed beyond reporting. The rules also allow flexibility for small businesses depending on their ability to pay. While these facilities will not be exempt from the rules, they may be granted a postponed compliance schedule. Finally, the rules incorporate a tiered approach to implementing this program. The agencies propose to start with approximately 80 facilities over the first 5 years. This is really an acknowledgement that we can't get to all facilities at once, and we want a system to look at the highest risk first. The prioritization framework for identifying the Tier 1 facilities incorporates risk data and data about communities living near a facility. So some of the elements included in this equation are percentage of communities of color, percentage of low income people in the community, percentage of children under the age of 5, and population density. So all of these factors, along with the risk posed, go into an equation to determine where the agencies will focus their initial efforts. So with this slide, I want to cover a bit of the timeline, the key milestones that are remaining in our rule development process. DEQ and OHA plan to publish draft rules and a draft fiscal impact statement for public comment in mid-October. There will be a 60-day public comment period approximately double the normal or standard public comment period time, allowing for what is expected to be many comments and a lot of engagement. We will be able to accept comment in a variety of ways, public hearings through the web or in writing. And we will also have public hearings during this public comment period. Each hearing will include a briefing on the rules and an opportunity for the public to ask questions. The dates and locations are not solidified yet, but we anticipate five hearings, likely to be in Medford, Coos Bay, Corvallis, Pendleton, and Portland. Once the public comment period closes, the agencies will review and respond to all public comments. The agency will consider changes to the draft rules based on the public comment and input. The Environmental Quality Commission is the body that's charged with adopting these rules. The agency will deliver proposed rules to the Environmental Quality Commission in late spring of 2018 for their consideration. So now I'll turn it back to Director Whitman.
Thank you. I want to finish this by talking about the funding for this program, because there are going to need to be additional resources for the agency to carry out this program, additional resources for both the Department of Environmental Quality and the Oregon Health Authority. DEQ will propose fees to implement the program. Initially, we'll put those out as part of the draft rules this fall for public comment to hear from the affected communities as well as businesses about those fees. And then we will come to the legislature in the short session in 2018 seeking approval of fees from this body to operate the program. So we look forward to further discussion with legislators, with the legislative bodies regarding this program. We do anticipate that by the time of the short session, we will have been through the public process for this, so we will have a set of pretty solid draft rules along with very extensive public input into this program to present as part of our discussion with you all. With that, I think we're going to go ahead and close, and we're very happy to take any questions committee members may have about this program.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that very clear presentation. Colleagues, we have about 10 minutes that we can devote to this. And let me start off with a question. So in terms of the effort to prioritize which facilities will be addressed first, two questions. What is the timeline for that? I mean, when will you decide what your scope of your timetable will be for that? Identify those that are going to be addressed first. And I'm wondering if companies like Bullseye Glass, just to put that out there, we know that there's been a problem, it's been identified, there's been monitoring, or some of those sites where there has been monitoring, we know there's a problem. Will those go to the front of the queue, assuming that they're in an area that meets those demographic profiles, the demographic profile that you identified?
Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, in terms of the timing, a key piece of that work to identify the highest priority facilities is enabled by a request that we made last November of all facilities that hold any form of air quality permit from the state. And so we have a more comprehensive emissions inventory in terms of emissions of air toxics in the state than we have ever had before. That inventory will be important in terms of this prioritization, but it's really just part of the picture. We also, as Deputy Director Felden indicated, will be looking at population density, environmental justice considerations, low income, in going through an analysis of which are the top 80 facilities that have the combination of the highest risk as well as risk to the most densely populated, most probably urban type areas. So that analysis will be started likely at the beginning of next year. We do not anticipate it being completed until probably the middle of next year. So we're doing that work really at the back end of the development of the rules, and that's because of some resource limitations that we have at this point in terms of the program development.
Let me say I really appreciate that strategy. I think it makes a lot of sense to focus on those areas of density initially. Will that work depend on the funding that you're requesting in the short session? Will you be able to do the analysis and, you know, to start moving forward absent that funding?
Co-Chair Dembro, members of the committees, to answer your question directly, the funding is needed to do that work. Some of the funding that we were looking for in the 2017 session would have helped us begin that process. Some of the positions that would be attached to that funding request will be for folks who help us with emissions inventory work, analysis, interpreting data, modeling. And this is the kind of groundwork, if you will, that is needed to really assess the facilities appropriately. There's also some work needed with the facilities. While we've made that initial emissions inventory request, we certainly want facilities who may potentially be on that in that first tier to have the opportunity to confirm their emissions and make sure that they fully understood the request the first time and submitted the information that they wanted to submit and that is accurate. So that that would be needed. And this, I wanted to just add as well, this equation that looks at the risk and also some factors of environmental justice and population density, that would be part of the rules. And so that's a piece that the public will get to comment on and give us input on, that those criteria and that actual equation. So we'll be starting to work on this list, but we will need to see what kind of input we get from the public before we know exactly what that approach will look like.
Great, thank you. Yes, Senator Bertrager.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Director Whitman, have you had this presentation? Have you given it to the U.S. Forest Service?
Chair Dembro, Senator Bartscheiger, haven't had that opportunity yet. I'm sure if we were asked by the U.S. Forest Service, we'd be happy to give it to them.
Is anybody here from the U.S. Forest Service? No, I'd strongly suggest it, because when they're burning up 500,000 acres in Oregon every year, that is diminishing immensely this conversation about industrial pollutants.
Representative Brock Smith.
Thank you. Good morning, Director.
Good morning.
And forgive my questions as I'm having a little trouble understanding the movement of Cleaner Air Oregon, considering that the legislation behind it failed to pass this body in the 17th session. And so when talking about rulemaking and the rulemaking process, I'm confused, because the Oregon legislature has chosen not to move forward with Cleaner Air Oregon, and yet here we are in rulemaking. And maybe it's just because I'm the new guy. But when you're talking about the needed funding, again, the legislature has chosen not to fund it. So I'm concerned that we have an agency. We know that we had a debacle in the session where some would say it was politically motivated against a certain business and from the DEQ. And so I'm wondering where we're going here, and I appreciate the slideshow and the update on legislation that, again, failed to pass this body. Therefore, in my mind, the Legislative Assembly does not want to move forward with this agenda that you're doing so anyway.
Chair Dembro, Representative Brock Smith, I appreciate the question. I really do. Because this has been a source of some confusion, I think, both here in Salem and perhaps in other areas of the state as well. I think because of some unfortunate reporting in the media. The fact is, DEQ has the authority to proceed with this rulemaking, number one. Number two, the legislature did appropriate funding for an air toxics program in the 2016 short session. The funding that the legislature did not approve in the past long session was funding for supplemental funding, one-time funding for this rulemaking effort that we're currently engaged in. And the supplemental funding specifically was for the analytical work on the emissions inventory to allow us to do upfront the prioritization that we are now proposing to do, if you will, at the back end of this process because of the failure to receive the funding. But at no time did we say or indicate to anyone that we were not moving forward with this program because of that vote in or failure to vote in Ways and Means. In fact, I believe I was clear on the record that we are moving forward with this program.
Actually, we're going to have to move on, Rep. I'm sorry. Rep. Marsh, Bence, and then Senator Roblin.
I was just wondering if you could say a few words about the collaboration between DEQ and OHA and how the work is being shared.
Thank you. Chair Dembro, Representative Marsh, another question that I really appreciate because the Department of Environmental Quality and the Oregon Health Authority have always worked together in various ways. We both have health in our missions to some degree. This program, however, has provided an opportunity, I think, with strong support from the Oregon Health Authority in particular, for the two agencies to really partner in a way that they have never done before on a program. And I think that is a unheralded real benefit of this effort to protect the public health of Oregonians that we now have the Department of Environmental Quality working very closely with the Health Authority. So the rule development team includes toxicologists, public health specialists, community outreach specialists from the Health Authority working together with DEQ staff to develop this program. So we wouldn't be here without the assistance of the Health Authority, and I personally very much appreciate the partnership.
Rep. Bence.
Thank you, Chair. thanks for all this work. I understand the challenge you face. Some folks approached me the other day in Ontario and asked if they should situate their large company in Oregon or in Idaho. They will be using natural gas as an energy source. And it crossed my mind. I didn't know where to start with the list of things that they would have to comply with in anticipation, among others, of this particular program. But are there other states engaged in similar efforts to yours that you've that provide guidance? That's one. And then the other, if not, how do we go to companies interested in coming to our state and say, hey, there's a level of uncertainty here by virtue of this ongoing activity to determine how you, the new company, will prove that you're not, as opposed to simply pointing at stuff, standards that federal standards that are met in other states. So it's a combination of questions as usual, so take your choice.
Chair Dembro, Representative Bence, I'll try to hit all of the pieces of that question, a set of great questions. First of all, with regard to activities in other states, many other states have industrial air toxics programs. Our neighbors to our north and to our south both have air toxics programs of the type that we are developing. But Many other states around the country do as well. So Oregon has been a bit behind the curve, if you will, if anything, in the development of this program. That said, we, like as you are, and I know other Oregonians are, we're also concerned about how this program may affect both the existing business community in Oregon and the potential for new industry to come into the state. One of the points we're trying to make with the presentation this morning is that we're being very cognizant of effects on both existing businesses and potentially new businesses. One of the worst things that can happen for a business is to be in a position where it is uncertain of what the requirements might be. And frankly, that's sort of where we're at right now. And Representative Brock Smith alluded to the situation from earlier this year. Again, I think the result of ambiguous state requirements with regard to air toxics. If we can put in place a program that is predictable and gives some level of certainty to industry, I think we will be benefiting both existing and potentially new businesses. The final thing I want to say about this is one thing we've learned here, and you'll appreciate this, is a relationship between the environmental side in terms of pollution control and land use. One of the lessons here is if a facility has high levels of air toxics emissions, one way of affecting that, particularly with regard to a newer business, is to not locate next to the neighborhood daycare center, not locate in a very dense urban residential community. And so, again, if we know prospectively what the requirements are, that will help a new business coming to a community identify an appropriate location.
Thank you.
Senator Roebling.
Yeah, and so I was happy to hear that as the rule process is going on, you're going to be identifying criteria for identifying the number of people, all of the kind of things you were talking about. When it comes to developing the model, is there another process and ways in which companies and others will actually see how that is being developed? Because how you develop a model that gives you that list of 80 is really important with respect to individual companies. So how are we going through that process as opposed to the rulemaking process with respect to, because the outcomes are going to get pushed out of that model and they're going to have 80 people predicted. So is there a discussion about how that model is being developed?
Why don't you start? Okay. Chair Dembrough and Senator Roebling, thank you for the question. The equation that I've referred to that looks at the risk that a facility poses as well as those other criterion, that is something that the team and the agencies developed. I believe we first spoke with the Rules Advisory Committee about that in July, if I remember correctly. It was certainly midsummer. And so that was a new element when we decided to do this tiering approach. And it was born out of realizing that we needed to start in a certain place and some thinking about what was the most logical way to start. So the first input that we've received on that model was from the Rules Advisory Committee. And we continue to receive input from them about that model, which does weight the different pieces differently, the risk as opposed to the population and the other criteria. So that's the first place where we're getting input on that model. And you're absolutely correct that will determine where we're first looking. The staff have done a little bit of work to make sure that they think that that's something that would make sense. But we have received input from the committee that may cause us to weight things a little bit differently. Some folks have expressed a desire to weight things differently or add more criteria.
If I might follow up, Chair Dembrough, Senator Roebling, Two things. Number one, we have the emissions inventory data. That those data need to then be used to calculate projected, and this is the modeling part, ambient air quality in the area around a facility. So that does involve an element of modeling. It's based on meteorological data. It's also based on the height of a stack of a particular facility. So there are a number of different inputs. But the second point I want to make, and the more important one, is the discussion draft rules that we have currently allow for a facility, if it wants, to do actual monitoring so that it can show what the actual ambient air quality is in the vicinity of the facility if it is not satisfied with the modeling. That always will be, at least right now, is anticipated to be an element of the program.
Great. And for our final question, the good Senate Vice Chair.
Thank you. Madam Director, Deputy Director, on your slide, you talked about risk analysis, and the companies are supposed to do their output and measuring and all that stuff. Did I hear you correctly to say that it's the company's responsibility to do the risk analysis for the citizens around their plant?
Chair Denbrough, Vice Chair Olson, yes. So the process, I'll describe a little bit of the process and see if I get to your question. The initial ask in the fall was that facilities submit their emissions to us. However, we did separate more complex facilities, major sources, from less complex facilities, more minor sources. So the major sources who are more accustomed to calculating these emissions for their more complex permit, to some degree for some toxics already, they are accustomed to doing that. They're used to using these calculations. And so we did ask them to submit the calculation to us. For the smaller facilities, we ask that they simply provide production data, and we're doing those calculations for them. Now,
you kind of missed the point of my question was, you are asking, a follow-up, you are asking the company to do the risk analysis for the community, predicated on what data they have supplied to you. How do you anticipate that they will do that? Do they have the expertise and technology to do that? And if it looks bad for them, are they going to tell you the truth?
Thank you, Senator Olson, for the clarification. So the program, if the program was adopted and we got to the point where facilities were going through the different tiers to determine their risk, it would, again, be a process where they're submitting the information to us. And at the lower levels, we would be doing, the department would be doing the initial screening modeling to determine if they need to be in the program at all. And if it's determined that they are in the program because they're above certain thresholds, then they would be doing that modeling. That's correct. The facilities and their owners best know their facilities and often want to do that calculation and want to do that modeling with their own consultants. They know how the facilities operate much better than the department does. We do agree upon a protocol so that up front it's understood between the facility and the department what sort of steps they will take and what the modeling will look like.
So what you just said is you are going to rely on them to provide you the impact of the community. Is that what you just said?
The facilities are able to do their modeling, yes. And the department verifies the protocol and reviews the modeling and ensures that we agree that the protocol is sound and that the inputs into that model were appropriate. We use our own risk-based concentrations to determine whether the emissions from the facility are posing a risk at certain risk action levels.
And then you would work with the company, presumably, on a remediation strategy or a containment strategy? Is that kind of the next step?
Chair Jembro, that is correct. The way that the draft discussion rules read right now, the company, if they are above certain risk action levels, they would work with the department on a risk reduction plan. So a plan may be spread out over time depending on what it is they need to do to reduce their risk. It will certainly need to be a plan that gives them time to determine what they need to do, what they want to do amongst the choices, and to plan appropriately.
If I could add something, Chair Dembro.
Introduce yourself.
Keith Johnson, assistant to the director and deputy director for the program. An additional factor I wanted to add to deputy director is that the program also seeks to, you know, sort of coordinate with existing Cleaner Air Act rules. So we don't necessarily want to start from scratch. So to add a little bit to the previous answer, there are times where facilities could be, to a certain extent, somewhat over some of these risk action levels, and there would be a review of their existing controls. And there are instances where those controls could be sort of the best controls you can have. There's a review process to look at that. And in that case, the department could allow certain continued operations, recognizing that that facility has sort of done the best controls that are generally accepted to be out there.
Okay, thank you. Colleagues, we could go on and on with this, but we're already 10 minutes behind. Thank you very much for the presentation.
Thank you.
You'll keep us abreast on how this is going. Okay, let's move on to our next items have to do with solar transportation, kind of, they're sort of related. We're going to start off with a report from the PUC on their dockets having to do with the value of solar and transportation electrification. So call up Jason Eisdorfer and Julie Peacock.
Hi, good morning. Chairs Helm and Dembro, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Julie Peacock, the Senior Policy Advisor at the Public Utility Commission. And with me this morning is Jason Eisdorfer, the Utility Program Director. We were asked to give you a brief update on commission activities. First, I'll start with an overview of the commission's mission. Next, briefly, we'll discuss current dockets, and finally discuss two dockets in depth, the resource value of solar and transportation electrification. The mission of the Public Utility Commission is to ensure utility customers have access to safe, reliable, and high-quality service at just and reasonable rates. At its core, the Commission is an economic regulator whose role was created and designed by the legislature. Our traditional function is rate making, and some of our relatively new processes include integrated resource planning, but we also enforce the National Safety Electrical Code. Now I want to highlight some of the work we're currently doing at the Commission. As you can see, we have quite a few dockets happening. The few I'll highlight here are, in the blue, our integrated resource plans. We are currently in the process with three of the electric utilities' integrated resource plans, Idaho Power, Portland General Electric, and Pacific Power. We also recently completed reviewing the Northwest Natural IRP earlier this year. And the yellow are two implementation pieces from SB 1547. The first is community solar, namely the development of the implementation manual and an RFP to competitively select a third-party administrator. And second, the beginning of the implementation of changes to our existing renewable portfolio standard rules to accommodate changes from SB 1547, and also to integrate new policy considerations that have emerged in the decades since we wrote these RPS rules. and the orange is energy storage. Under HB 2193, Portland General Electric and Pacific Power were required to procure one or more new energy storage systems that provided at least 5 megawatt hours of energy and up to 1% of the utility's peak load by 2020. When it passed, HB 2193, Oregon was only the second state to have a storage requirement. However, since then, many states have followed. The commission is currently in the process of developing guidelines that the utilities will use when creating their storage proposals. And the green are rate cases. Currently, we're in the process of reviewing a rate case filed by PGE. We recently concluded a rate case filed by Avista, and in December, we're anticipating a rate case be filed by Northwest Natural. And in the purple, which you can not really see very well there at the bottom, but was just filed on Thursday, is the merger between Hydro One and Avista. So we're just starting to review that application that was filed. Now, Jason Eisdorfer will provide more detail on the resource value of solar.
Thanks, Julie. Chairs Denbro and Helm, I'm Jason Eisdorfer, Utility Program Director at the Public Utility Commission. I'm going to spend just a few minutes talking about the resource value of solar, or ARVOS, as we've shortened it to. It's a relatively new but growing phenomenon that customers are able to generate their own electricity and deliver that back to the distribution system. So ARVOS is a tool that attempts to quantify the various values that and potential costs that come from distributed solar on the utility system. By identifying and quantifying those values of solar generation, the solar generator is being paid, or ultimately being paid, the full value of the that they bring to the system. And other customers, the non-participating, the non-generating customers, are paying the right price for that energy delivered to the system. Ultimately, over time, and as ARVOS matures, it can help identify where on the system new solar generation might bring additional value or might cause additional costs to the distribution system. It would send price signals to the generator, the distributed generator, to influence on the system where new generation might be encouraged or where it might be not encouraged. Ultimately, this would help optimize the distribution system. ARVOS is a tool that ultimately can help realize the potential of distributed generation on the system by both delivering the full value to the solar generator, but also attempting to optimize the system by locating solar in the right place on the distribution system. So here are the values that the parties have identified that are worthy of additional analysis to attempt to quantify. Let me just pull out a couple for you. The energy and capacity value that a utility might would have to generate or purchase, but for the distributed solar that's being added to the system. One value could be in deferring distribution or transmission investments because the distributed generation is serving a need locally rather than from a distance. Another one, as you can see up there, are line losses that would be avoided by having a more localized generation. So the first couple up there, energy generation, transmission, and line losses, represent the relatively significant majority of the quantifiable costs. But there are those other values that are on that list, such as potentially RPS compliance value or other ancillary services. Not all of these values may be quantifiable in the near term. There's still additional data that may need to be collected in order to be able to actually quantify some of these points. And then finally, I just want to talk about our next steps. We, the Commission just issued an order closing out phase one of this docket last week. Phase two begins with utilities beginning to use the methodology that phase one identified for those 11 values and conduct its own analysis to attempt to quantify those values. Stakeholders will have an opportunity to weigh in on that, and ultimately we will identify values for each of those elements. And RVOs ultimately will evolve. This is starting relatively early because we don't have all of the data. We may require additional investment, smart grid investment on the distribution system simply to accommodate additional analysis by providing additional data. So locational values may be relatively gross at this point, but over time we may get down to the feeder level. That is the concept. So this same concept could be used to identify other technologies on the distribution system, on the customer side of the meter. For example, storage or potentially even energy efficiency. So this is a tool that we're working on now. It's rather complicated. There are a number of moving pieces, but over time, we hope to be able to apply it to a number of different kinds of technologies. So with that, I'll turn it back to Julie to talk about transportation electrification.
Actually, before you go on, Jason, so what do you see as the timetable for this work?
Chair Dembro, excellent question. Probably into the middle of, this is my best guess, middle of next year. I think hopefully we'll try to get some numbers working. That was clearly the Commission's hope and intent in the order that they produced last week.
Thank you.
Great. So transportation electrification, SB 1547 required the state's investor-owned utilities, Idaho Power, Pacific Power, and Portland General Electric to file applications for programs to accelerate transportation electrification. These programs were required to be filed with the Commission by December 31st of last year. All three utilities filed programs to accelerate transportation electrification by the required deadline. With the design of SB 1547, there was built-in flexibility that allowed the utilities to design the programs best suited for their service territories. For example, Idaho Power's program will focus on education and outreach, namely the benefits of electric vehicle ownership, which is in line with its rural service territory, while one of Portland General's programs is proposed to provide 5 charging stations to TriMet's home base use and 1 in-route fast charger, which matches with the urban nature of its service territory. As currently envisioned, the size of these programs are designed to be pilots, allowing the utilities to make investments and work to develop methodologies to quantify the program's impact on accelerating transportation electrification. This gives stakeholders and the Commission time to test the design of these programs and collect data to better understand the zero-emission vehicle market. Except for Idaho Power, these programs are currently still under review. Idaho Power's program was approved by the Commission earlier this year. Another way we're planning to integrate planning for the growth of transportation electrification is the design of long-term plans. These long-term plans will enable the utilities to manage the growth of zero-emission vehicles while optimizing ZEVs, as they're called, growth on the utility system. These are some of the highlights of what we're currently working on, and I'd be happy to answer questions for you or Jason as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Colleagues. Yes, Rep. Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me repeat the Chair's question earlier. When do you expect that you'll be in a position to implement the rulemaking for the long-term plans?
Chair Dembro, Chair Helm, Representative Barnhart, we expect we'll start the rulemaking at the beginning of the year. A lot of the issues that around what will go into the long-term plans have already been discussed by stakeholders, so we feel like it'll be a fairly easy rulemaking process. We're just balancing some of the other rulemakings we have going on currently.
Mr. Chair, quick follow-up. I appreciate that very much. You're very aware, I'm sure, that a lot of automobile companies are manufacturing or about to manufacture actually competent electric vehicles that people of ordinary incomes can afford to buy. my expectation is that utilities are going to find themselves with a lot of work to do if they're ready to go ahead.
Crunch for the masses.
Yes.
Rep. Spence and Johnson. Rep. Spence.
Thank you for the presentation. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I have has to do with the phrase, the resource value of ARBOs refers to the benefits that accrue to a utility system. That must have carried with it the detriments and the costs. But I was curious. I just went online and tried to find a similar study for wind, so the resource value of wind. And the reason I looked at it is because of an article some years ago in The Economist magazine about the negative impact upon renewables in Germany on existing utility systems. Negative in the sense that there was huge amounts of subsidies poured into those kinds of those green resources without appropriate attention paid to the impact or negative impact it would have upon our utility system. And so I'm just curious, A, do you have a resource value of wind, something similar to this? And B, if you have both, do they address this negative impact of subsidized green upon existing IOUs?
Chairs Denbrough and Helm, Representative Vince, I guess the short answer to the question is do we attempt to consider the costs of wind or any additional resource? The answer is yes. So when utility-scale wind, for example, is brought into the fold, the total cost will be considered, including integration costs. The resource value of solar is a little bit different in the sense that we're really focusing on now, for the first time, trying to quantify resources that a customer can bring to the system as opposed to the utility. So in both circumstances, whether it's a utility-scale resource or within ARBOs, we would be looking at both the costs and benefits. So some on the list that we had up earlier are going to end up being values that other ratepayers should be paying for, but also identify costs that additional solar might bring to the system.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jason, I was at a clean energy conference in Colorado last week, and lots of conversations going on about solar and how it interacts with the duck curve. As you remember, about demand, right? Like that, you know, during the day when people are at work or playing, you know, out of the house, that sort of thing, demand is low. It ramps up when people get home. Solar generation obviously is maxing out during the day, trends down when folks come home again and they want to turn on their lights and cook dinner and so forth. So I'm guessing, I'm looking at your list of the identified elements of the resource value, and where in there could you factor in perhaps a different pricing mechanism or value mechanism for solar that could be modified to be producing later in the day, i.e., let's say west-facing panels rather than south-facing panels when the sun, you know, later in the day. Is that a calculation, or is that something that's being considered as you put together your resource value plan? Where solar actually is producing at the time when the grid has the greatest demand for it.
Chairs Denbrough and Helm, Representative Johnson. I do think that would be considered in the generation capacity value potentially. I think ultimately the theory here is that we would come up with would be able to quantify a value for the generator, him or herself. And so if that generator is west-facing or potentially over time even has storage associated with it, all those values ultimately will be able to apply to that generator. In a situation where, to Representative Bence's point, there's too much solar on a feeder line, that the price signal would be one of not encouraging additional solar there, where a substation could manage it and it helps actually reinforce the grid, or that energy is combined with solar and is brought in on a longer term basis. All those values ultimately, hopefully, if we do this right, will accrue to the generator, but it's also a fair price that other customers can would pay.
Yeah, other states are considering kind of a variable pricing mechanism, if you will, for net metering for the return to the investor. You're going to get less return on your investment during that time of the day when your system's producing power and the grid really doesn't need it, but you're going to get a premium if you're actually producing power when the grid is in need of that. And a follow-up would be, you mentioned storage. As we talk about expanding community-based solar and so forth, other states are considering, again, how solar generation coupled with storage would have a much higher value to the grid than simply generation alone. And as you know, battery storage technology is accelerating rapidly. So I'm just hopeful as you go through this rulemaking process that we're looking forward, so we're ready for, you know, providing incentives that really are going to be reflective of what the market and what technology is able to, you know, produce.
Chair Zambro and Helm, Representative Johnson, we are trying to get a little bit ahead of the curve. I will say, I mentioned in the presentation that some of these values are going to may not be quantifiable at this point, but over time we've included them, trying to develop the methodology for them, and when we get the data, hopefully they will be quantified. But precisely what you just said, we are trying to get ahead of the curve.
Thank you.
Okay, Rep. Marsh, and then Senator Olson.
Thank you. I'm wondering if you could provide any comments on what this analysis would look like if we incorporated the social cost of carbon.
Chair Zembro and Helm, Representative Marsh, it depends upon what that cost is, but inevitably I think it would, I suppose, disfavor resources that were fossil fuel based, and so it would tend to elevate the value of renewable energy.
Okay, Senator Olson, you're fine.
Thank you. Does the PUC or the utilities have a the term is not that I want to use is not planned, but do you foresee what the growth of electric vehicles will be in the future, and how do you anticipate what that growth is, because it really hasn't been astronomical to date?
Senator, Chair Denbrough, Chair Helm, Senator Olson, I think that we're hoping that the long-term plans, that rulemaking process, the utilities, stakeholders will work together to have a better idea of the projected growth of EVs in each utility service territory. We agree there hasn't been a lot of data out there to date about how EVs will grow in the utility service territory. We've talked with the Northwest Power and Planning and Conservation Council about the numbers they included in the 7th Power Plan to look at their model to see what other entities in the Northwest are making those projections.
Okay, thank you very much for this.
Thank you.
Okay, so our next, we dig a little deeper into the EV charging station issue, and I'd like to call up Aaron Milano, Eli Morris, and Smart. Let's do just the thing. Ann, you want to come on?
He's the safety man.
Yeah, exactly.
If you can bear sitting next to these guys, I'm sure they'd love to have you. Okay, Aaron, do you want to start it off?
Sure. Senator Denbrough, excuse me, Chair Denbrough, Chair Helm, members of the committee, I'm Aaron Milano with Portland General Electric. Portland General Electric is an electric utility that serves about 850,000 customers in Oregon. We represent 70% of the commercial industrial load in Oregon. I'm proud to work at PGE. I go to work every day knowing that the work I'm doing is actively contributing to the development of Oregon's clean energy future. With that, today we have about 15% of our generation mix is renewable. We have plans on the horizon in our integrated resource plan to get to 50% renewables. Today I'm here to talk about transportation electrification. Transportation electrification is a really important part of that carbon-free future for several reasons. One is the clear and obvious one, that it represents decarbonizing mobility. The second key component, however, is the flexible load associated with electric vehicles. And when I say electric vehicles, I use the term generally to include buses, ships, trains, et cetera. It's not meant to just be passenger vehicles, trucks also. The flexibility that load provides actually helps create opportunity for us to integrate renewables into our system at a lower cost. We think there's a lot of opportunity there. And respond to, I think it was maybe Senator Olson's, Vice Chair Olson's comment about forecasts, PGE today has about 10,000 electric vehicles, just shy of that in our service area. We anticipate over the next 10 years, over 200,000 electric vehicles in the service area. So pretty substantial jump that can be pretty disruptive to our system if we weren't to plan for integrating those into our system. Fortunately, we are taking an active role in thinking about how we're going to utilize these as a resource, not just incremental load. And finally, we think there's potential that in our preliminary analysis shows that electric vehicles actually have the opportunity to provide downward rate pressure on all customers, because typical charging behaviors happen in off-peak hours and allow us to utilize existing assets, allow us better utilization of existing assets. So today I'm here to discuss our plan, which was briefly mentioned earlier. We have three main components to our transportation electrification plan. One is six public quick charging sites. For those of you who have seen in our headquarters downtown, we have Electric Avenue. There's six chargers with dual heads, which means that they can charge all types of vehicles. We think that this provides value for several reasons. One is visibility. When I talk to my customers about their knowledge of transportation electrification, most customers aren't aware that it's an option for them to consider when buying a vehicle. When I ask, and I'd encourage everybody to do this with your peers, if you ask your neighbors or your family where their nearest gas station is, almost everybody can answer that question. But if you ask them where their nearest public charger is, I rarely find somebody who can answer that question. And then accessibility. Many people are often surprised to learn that all electric vehicles cannot charge at every single charging station. There are multiple charging ports. If you include Tesla, there are three different charging ports. And that means if I go buy an electric vehicle today and I go to the first charger that I see on the road, that thing doesn't necessarily work for my car. So we think it's really important to provide dual heads so that all vehicles can charge there. And we also think that co-locating them is extremely important, so that if somebody gets there before me, that I'm able to get a charge and use the charger right next to them. Quick charging sites like this also support folks who do not have access to home charging, either because they don't have off-street parking, they live in multifamily units. There's what we call fleets without home. There's a growing interest in car share services and vehicles that are on the road all the time. Uber and Lyft drivers use our chargers downstairs, and we think it's really important to support the growth of electrification of those sectors as our mobility needs change over time. The second component of our proposal is outreach and technical assistance. This is really focused on supporting fleets and workplace sustainability managers, et cetera, and considering how they consider electric vehicles for their fleets, what are the considerations they need to make, and what are the considerations they need to make when siting charging infrastructure, what chargers are going to work for them, and how can they save money by siting in one location over another. The third component, as mentioned earlier, of our proposal is installing five chargers for TriMet so that they can electrify a route, an entire route. This is really important because it allows them to test the operations of running an electric bus route, which is significantly different when they think about how they charge, where they charge, when they charge, who charges the vehicle, there's a lot of operational considerations that are really important before they go to scale and electrify their entire fleet. So this is a really important learning opportunity for them. We are really excited about being on the ground with them because it's paving the way for a long-term integrated, what I call transportation distribution system planning, where we can identify locations on our system that are beneficial for the transportation sector, but also for the distribution system to co-locate charging infrastructure in the future. So if you step back and look at that portfolio on a whole, I think you might recognize that it's modest. It's modest by design. We want to, through this first pass, to really learn and understand what those benefits are for both participating and non-participating customers. As I indicated earlier, we do think there's benefits for all customers, but we want to, go out with a much larger proposal, and we'll consider this in future plans, but we do want to make sure we're learning and our investments are prudent. As many of you may know, Senate Bill 1547 outlines several considerations for the Commission to consider our proposal. That's the ability to integrate renewables, efficiently integrate into the grid, to be used and useful, and also to provide support competition innovation for our customers. And what I would encourage folks to do, and I encourage the Commission to do as well, is to consider our portfolio as a portfolio, how we're doing that, because I think it's really important to not look at individual components of our proposals, but rather the whole portfolio, because it was planned and thoughtfully executed to touch our broad customer base. And so I suspect you'll hear from other folks this morning that there are some concerns about the how our proposal supports competition and innovation. And I would just say, consider broadly what that term of the legislation means, because for us, we think that by supporting our facility and fleet managers in electrifying their fleets and considering new options, supporting the transit agencies and considering new options, supporting the transportation network and car share companies and considering new options for their vehicles and their charging, our RFP for competitive procurement for the charging infrastructure itself, we believe all these elements are supportive of an innovative and competitive landscape that we're hoping to build here. And we do have support for our proposal. We have 10 people that have signed on, 10 organizations that have signed on to our settlement agreement that's before the Commission, including charging manufacturers and charging service providers, including the Commission staff. We're very excited about the proposal. We're hoping that we'll get approval here shortly. So, in short, we've had a modest by design proposal, and we really think this is a foundational first step for us in the transportation electrification space, and look forward to doing more in the future. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Aaron. Okay, Eli.
Good morning, Chairs Dembrough and Helm, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Eli Morris. I am Customer Solutions Program Manager at Pacific Power. Pacific Power provides electric service to roughly 600,000 Oregonians across all sides of the state and has customers and assets in 28 of Oregon's 36 counties. We've, on the map, highlighted our service area to show its dispersed, largely rural nature. And also, we've overlaid the green dots, which are the public electric vehicle charging stations that are currently available in Oregon. Although they may vary in their availability, their reliability, their visibility, and to Aaron's point, which vehicles can plug into them. When we looked across our entire Oregon service territory, we found only a handful of fast charging stations that any vehicle could plug into. And the lack of infrastructure does create a problem when we're thinking about accelerating transportation electrification, both in terms of drivers being able to drive further and know that they can get where they need to go on electricity, and for drivers who may not have the option to plug in their vehicle at home and would really rely on that public charging infrastructure. So a lot has happened over the last 18 months since the passage of Senate Bill 1547, both work that Pacific Power's done and work that others have done. We actively participated in the OPUC's rulemaking process, which we found to be very open and thoughtful, workshops and comment periods that we participated in. At the same time, we started talking to our customers and communities about what the opportunities and challenges were for electric transportation in our service territory. And that led up to the development of our proposals that we filed December 27th of last year pursuant to the legislation, which were three pilot programs and one new rate, which I'll talk about the specifics a little bit later. Based on conversations with OPUC staff, we supplemented that application in April to include additional information on the market in general, Pacific Power service territory, and the program details. We filed that in April. Our new rate was approved June 1st of this year. We're excited about that. And then after the filing of those programs, we worked with stakeholders to reach a settlement agreement, recognizing that there were some concerns, especially with this being the first time that these programs have been proposed in Oregon. We filed that settlement agreement on April 11th, and a couple weeks later, ChargePoint objected to that settlement agreement, which has extended our regulatory process into early next year. Our application included support from a broad base of our communities and customers, including local governments, environmental advocates, clean cities coalitions, electric vehicle charging companies, auto manufacturers. And the settlement agreement was reached in collaboration with Oregon Public Utilities Commission staff, the Oregon Department of Energy, the Citizens Utility Board, industrial customers, Fourth Mobility, and Green Lots, who is a provider of electric vehicle charging services. ChargePoint is the only party to the docket that does not support the settlement agreement. So I mentioned that one of our first priorities as we thought about what we would propose is to understand what our communities need. And we did that by going and hosting in-person workshops in Portland, Medford, and Bend over the summer and talking to our customers and communities. And we identified some significant opportunities and areas where we heard there was a role for utilities to play. That included increasing awareness of transportation electrification options and benefits. We have this existing relationship with our customers and are trusted advisor to them, particularly when it comes to energy issues. Increasing the availability of charging infrastructure, as we saw from the map, especially in our service area and even within our Portland service area, there's not a lot of charging infrastructure available. If we could decrease the upfront cost of vehicles and or chargers, that could spur additional adoption. And then we heard that our standard rate designs may be causing a barrier to adoption and development of fast charging stations in particular. So we took this feedback and we developed our draft programs. We sent those out to stakeholders at the end of October, and we took the feedback we received to further modify and flesh out those programs that we filed in December. So now I'm going to go into what those proposals were. And we think this represents a measured approach to our involvement in transportation electrification at a fairly low cost, which can allow us to test the benefits and challenges and effectiveness of different strategies for accelerating transportation electrification. So we've proposed an outreach and education program, which includes a few different channels of educating customers on the benefits and options for electric transportation. Those would include company communications to customers, and I've included an example there that we recently developed, which lets customers know that on our residential rates, it's the equivalent of $1 a gallon. Metrics that they can really understand and that they can use to see that they have a choice in transportation electrification and transportation fuels. Self-service resources, tools on our website that will let customers customize what options they might like to see and the costs and benefits of those. Funding community events such as ride and drive events that we've said we would organize some ride and drive events. We'd also make funding available for other events that could promote the benefits of transportation electrification. And then providing on-site technical assistance to non-residential customers who are considering putting in infrastructure but may not understand the best place to site it, what it will do to their electric rates, and so on.
And Eli, if you could wrap it up.
Okay, sure.
Thanks.
The next is three initiatives that we hope will stimulate the development of additional infrastructure. The first I mentioned is a rate for public fast charging, which will decrease the cost of operation of these stations. The second is grant funding for innovative customer-owned projects, especially those that can provide data that will inform future program development. And the third is Pacific Power owning and operating some fast charging infrastructure in our service territory. Lastly, I just wanted to highlight a couple other initiatives outside of Senate Bill 1547. We're electrifying our own fleet and have committed to invest in it at least 5% of our fleet replacement budget in plug-in technologies. And we're also looking for local partnerships, including partnering with Forth and others on a project to test low-income car sharing in one of our communities. Thank you, and I'll be available for questions.
Great. Thank you. Anne.
Thank you, Chair Dembrough, Chair Helm, and members of the Senate and House Committee. My name is Ann Smart, and I am the Vice President of Public Policy for North America at ChargePoint. We are the largest network of electric vehicle charging stations, all of which are independently owned and operated by private businesses and utilities and homeowners. We have more than 525 ports here in Oregon and more than 40,000 across the world. Last week, ChargePoint celebrated its 10-year anniversary. We will be making announcements about that shortly. But I've been at the company for about 3 years and can say that we have learned a lot about the industry, how it works, what our customers, site hosts, and drivers are looking for, and how we can be successful in expanding EV charging networks. We're here today to talk about what has happened since the legislature. You passed Senate Bill 1547. Throughout ChargePoint's engagement in that process, we voiced concerns about the potential for negative impacts on the market for electric vehicle charging if the utility programs were designed in a way that limited competition, customer choice, and innovation. I want to thank all of you and other members of the legislature that responded to our concerns and passed a great piece of legislation that included language requiring the utilities to consider programs that support competition, innovation, customer choice, and to also make sure that the programs push forward allow for benefits to ratepayers and don't add additional costs. Unfortunately, while there are parts of both Pacific Power and PGE's programs that we do like, including the demand charge reform for Pacific Power, both programs we feel failed to meet the requirements of Senate Bill 1547. And this isn't just my opinion. The commission staff, staff from the Attorney General's office, the settlement itself notes that there is not an agreement that these settlement proposals align with Senate Bill 1547, but that arguments have been made that they are pilots and should be allowed to move forward anyway. And we don't agree with that. We think it's very important for Oregon that we set good precedent now and that we develop utility programs that are scalable. ChargePoint would be first to say that we need more charging stations in Oregon. As Representative Barnhart said, we do need to see more charging stations in order to sell more electric vehicles and meet our state goal. But our concern is that the model that is proposed here, in both cases where Pacific Power and PGE would own and operate a small number of fast charger sites, is a model that does not allow for competition in that it will become increasingly difficult to sell at full cost a charging station anywhere around those sites if it becomes a mentality that charging stations are something that utilities exclusively should own and operate. We're also concerned that it creates a precedent that is not scalable due to cost. We believe that the utilities could have proposed programs for the same cost, for example, PGE's at almost $4 million, that instead of supporting six sites where the utilities fully own and operate all of the stations, that they could provide a portion of the cost for more than 500 sites at that same amount that supported either the installation cost or the equipment cost with other business models that we have proposed and that have been implemented in California, Utah, Nevada, Ohio, Massachusetts, and have been described in countless pages of testimony here at the legislature as well as at the commission and around the country. But unfortunately, the utilities, who have been supported by some EV charging companies that rely solely on utility funding, have refused to even consider these programs. And we've found that it's been difficult to have further conversations about different business models that we do believe would be more scalable and better for the long-term interests of Oregon. And I ask, what was the point of working on this legislation if it isn't actually being used to evaluate the proposals that we have before us? I appreciate this hearing and the ability to bring these issues to light. ChargePoint's fully committed to working with utilities. We were very excited when Senate Bill 1547 passed. I went to my investors, my board, and said, Oregon's going to be the next state with utility partnerships that enable us to sell more stations. But it was clear once the proposals were filed that that was not aligned with the legislation and was not going to be in the best interest of the market. So unfortunately, we're having new conversations about Oregon, and I hope that we will work something out in these cases that allow us to continue to grow here in the state. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Anne. And obviously, there's a contested case here. We're engaged in a process. Do we have a sense of the timeline for that process? Probably could have asked the PUC before, but do you all have a sense of how long we have to wait before this is determined at that level?
Chair Dembro, we have a public hearing with the commissioners on October 10th for our workshop and. Hopefully shortly thereafter.
Yeah. Is that your sense too, Eli?
Yes, Chair Dembro, Chair Helm, committee members. Yes, we're about a month behind PGE in the process. So similar process, similar general schedule. Ours will be a little later.
Okay, thank you. Sorry, Rick Johnson. Damn.
We're ahead of schedule.
No, we're behind.
Oh, but all right. I'll be brief. Anne, appreciate you being here today. As I said, I was at a conference in Denver last week about clean energy and heard from other states that ChargePoint's been pretty active there as well. And for whatever reason, you were adamantly opposed to utility ownership of any sort of charging facilities. And I'm just, I don't understand that, I guess, as we all try to talk about what we can do to create put in place the systems. It's a chicken and egg type thing, I guess. You know, Rep. Barnhart down here is advocating for more and more electric vehicles, and the utilities are being true to the letter of the intent in Senate Bill 1547, which says try to go forward with a competitive process to put in more infrastructure. So I guess, ChargePoint does, you engage in other states, you're putting in systems and so forth. What's preventing you from doing your own thing here in Oregon apart from this docket and so forth now? Is there anything preventing ChargePoint from going out and installing capacity now and providing that service for folks?
Chair Dembro, Chair Helm, Representative Johnson. So first and foremost, ChargePoint is not opposed to utility ownership. In fact, we are partners with utilities in San Diego Gas and Electric in California, Kansas City Power and Light in Kansas and Missouri, where the utility does own the charging station. We believe that when there is utility ownership, however, there should be multiple charging vendors in those programs and that the site host should have choice in equipment. So, for example, if PGE were to implement customer choice in its program, we believe that if they own and operate the stations, they should offer site hosts multiple options that are qualified into utility requirements in terms of network capabilities and grid benefits. But we're not opposed to utility ownership. We just want to make sure that the market is competitive and that the site host, rather than exclusively a utility, is making the choices as to the technology that's most appropriate for that location and the unique drivers that visit it. To your second question, ChargePoint is actively selling stations here in Oregon. We think it's been a good market. It's struggled historically because Years ago, there was a similar program where one company had the ability to install charging stations free of charge to site hosts. It was Blink Network. It made it very difficult for other companies like us at ChargePoint to sell stations when site hosts were expecting something for free. We're very concerned that PGE and Pacific Power's business models that they've chosen here will continue to further that type of mentality and make it difficult for us to sell stations when the expectations from customers is that they don't need to pay for a station, the utility will provide that service. We've already found that that is becoming a difficult conversation with customers right now because they're aware of these proposals and the press around them. And we're concerned that if this is the model that is being piloted and tested, that it will become the longer term utility proposal and something that isn't sustainable and will make it difficult for us to sell more in the future.
And let me just say, I own an electric vehicle now. I have a Chevy Bolt, and I get most of my power from Pacific Power because they service my home, and I do most of my charging at home. But if I have to go beyond 230 miles, then I use what is generally ChargePoint. And I would just love to see us have more stations as quickly as possible.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
One real quick question. PGE Pacific Core, do you put these charging stations in and make the ratepayers pay for them as a capital assessment?
Chair Dembo, Chair Helm, Vice Chair Olson, the intent is that these will go into to rates, yes. Through our analysis that we've included in our filing, we do anticipate that the benefits and the system benefits that I expressed earlier in terms of better utilization of our system that will come as a result of the installation of these chargers will exceed those costs and have a negative pressure long term on rates.
Yeah, Chair Dembro, Chair Helm, members of the committee, we have proposed something similar to PGE where over time, it would go into rates, though we don't know if there will be a net cost to customers. Drivers will pay for the use of these stations. That revenue will go to offset the cost of the capital and operation and maintenance. So that's part of the idea of the pilot is to test whether these stations can pay for themselves and have no cost to ratepayers, or potentially even be a net benefit to ratepayers.
Thank you. Okay, last question, Senator Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Just a quick question. At what tipping point, I guess what I'm trying to say is how many cars can we have in Oregon before our grid will no longer handle it? So how do we have a number? I know you guys had to talk about that somewhere along the line.
Chair Dembro, Chair Helm, members of the committee, it's a very challenging question, and it oftentimes is very locational specific in terms of kind of similar to the question about the resource value of solar and high potential basically overpenetrating individual feeders. At a system level, we do not foresee any impacts today. However, important thing to consider is that charging manufacturers and car companies are looking at quicker charging infrastructure. So a quick charger today uses about 50 kilowatts. There are plans to make 350 kilowatt quick chargers in the future. These are being developed, and this goes along with customer expectations to be able to get their gas really quickly. It's kind of that same mentality. If those and many bus chargers go on to specific feeders, then there could be some feeder level impacts. What's important for us in these pilots is that we demonstrate when and where those issues are occurring and develop pricing structures to help incentivize customers to utilize the devices at times that are favorable for the grid, because if we can control, basically stagger when people charge in a manner that's appropriate, it can have no negative consequences. Further, we're also doing a research pilot with two-way energy flows where we're basically exporting power from the vehicles, in which case there's potential that vehicles could offset themselves and one vehicle charges another, presumably. So thanks.
Great. Well, I want to thank all three of you for coming and really appreciate your comments. We have two additional speakers for this subject. Jim Ross and Jeff Allen, if you two could come up. And yes, we are running a little over, so if you could be brief, that would be great. Sorry.
Thank you. I'll try to restrain my Irishness. My name's Chair Dembro, Chair Helm. My name's Jim Ross. I'm here with the Electric Vehicle Charging Association. Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate coming up here. The EVCA is a nonprofit trade association founded in 2015. We have a whole group of members, currently including ABM, ChargePoint, Clean Fuel Connection, Cyber Switching, Envision Solar, EV Connect, EVgo, SemiConnect, Volta Charging. And just to be clear about something that was on the record earlier, we're also against the proposed settlement. So just, you know, make sure that, you all know that our organization, our groups are against it. There's no doubt, and we've been hearing about it, that Oregon needs to build out and expand its electric vehicle infrastructure. You know, kind of the question here, the debate here now is not that that needs to happen, but it's how. What's the best way? And, you know, as was brought up earlier, EVCA, ChargePoint, we're involved in states throughout the country, and there's some best models that have been, best practices that have been coming up, you know, kind of again and again that we're seeing that really works. For example, in Massachusetts, National Grid has proposed a program using rebate and make ready, in which the commercial site host will have its choice of qualifying EV charging equipment, and the utility would then offset the reasonable installation and upgrade costs. You know, in return, the utility monitors the data, can, you know, create incentives, those types of systems, so that it is actually smoothed out and increases the build out. Ohio just 4 weeks ago reached an agreement on a pilot program submitted by its major utilities, AEP, in collaboration with our EVCA and other environmental groups to implement a rebate incentive program in the Columbus area. Applicants could receive up to 100% reimbursement on the cost of charging stations, and additional 10% of funds are being set aside for stations in low-income communities. And then in California, Pacific Gas and Electric, always get them confused, PG&E, created a hybrid approach in which most cases the utility installs and owns the make-ready, the wiring, that part of it, and charging infrastructure, and then provides rebates to the site host and to own and operate the actual charging station. There's a limited ownership stake, an exception that PG&E is allowed to own and operate up to 35% of the charging stations. They get a piece, they get to own and operate them. I don't know if they need another headache, though. So, but these are all kind of the shared approach, right? You know, the idea is, you know, we want to kind of create competition. We want to create a shared approach to this program, an approach that allows consumer choice, does not create long-term dependency on ratepayer subsidies, and maximizes the resources available to create the most charging stations possible. You know, in regards to the pilot program, which we just filed a stipulation on, you know, you want to, the pilot program, you want to test the viability of the broader system, right? You know, the program you're going to end up with, you want to test it in the pilot program. Because if you mess it up in the pilot program, then you have to go back and start all over again. You know, when people are talking about, oh, you're, you know, set us back a month or you set us back a couple months, it's important that you get the pilot program right. Because if you don't and you have to go back and redesign it, then you're back to square one or back further. We think that utilities, you know, we're not against, you know, I know there's a sense, oh, you're anti-utility. No, utilities are a real unique position to play or in this whole thing. You know, they're the group that's going to, you know, really drive the deploying the infrastructure. They already have control over the energy grid, which is, you know, something that's very concerned here. And they can really help bring EV charging to disadvantaged communities. But, you know, as Oregon moves beyond pilot programs to develop a robust EV charging infrastructure, it should look to other states, to other places that are forging partnerships between public utilities and private industry to really bring the most charging stations to consumers as possible.
Thank you very much, Jim.
Thank you.
Jeff.
Great.
Good morning, Co-Chairs Dembro and Helm. I'm Jeff Allen. I'm Executive Director of Forth. Some of you know us as Drive Oregon, also a nonprofit trade association founded back in 2011. And we represent the entire electric vehicle and smart mobility ecosystem. So charging stations, most of the major automakers, utilities, local governments, and NGOs involved in this space. And we've been engaged as well in 1547 throughout. So I want to talk a little bit about some concerns we have about the process and the proposals, sort of from a different perspective, but then why we ultimately support these proposed plans. So our concerns, again, from the ecosystem as a whole, is that the scale of these programs is really far too modest. I mean, you've heard that they were modest by design. They were, frankly, also modest in concern of wanting to get something that could be moved fairly quickly. And that's our second concern, is that it's moving fairly slowly. But to give you a sense, the scale of these programs is not only small compared to, say, the California utilities on a per rate payer basis, but it's smaller than utilities like Avista here in the Spokane region have proposed. So we're concerned about whether these programs are going to ramp up quickly enough. The second is that there's been, throughout the process and coming from some of the stakeholders and PUC staff, too much of an emphasis on the infrastructure. That's really all we're hearing about today is the charging stations. But the truth is, more than half of consumers, even in California, have no idea that a zero-emission vehicle exists as an option for them. So whether it's a chicken and egg problem, or as we prefer to talk about it, as a hot dog and bun problem, right? Hot dogs are great. You can buy one even without buns if the hot dog is the electric vehicle. But they never seem to have the right number of buns to go with them, right? So that's kind of the problem that we're dealing with. But our contention is we need to focus on getting more electric vehicles on the road. And that's the best way to make the charging industry more competitive, is to have more vehicles using those charging stations. And that brings us to our final concern with the process, which is that I think there's some disagreement or confusion about the purpose and the language that's in 1547, which to us says very in a straightforward way that utilities must submit plans to accelerate transportation electrification. Some of the stakeholders are interpreting that as utilities must submit plans to react to electric vehicles coming or to try and maximize grid benefits. So we think that that long list of criteria that's in the legislation, such as promoting innovation and competition, are constraints that the utility should think about as it's accelerating transportation electrification. Just as utilities are required to adopt a renewable portfolio standard by a certain amount of renewable energy, we want them to do it in as most cost-effective a way as possible and as smart a way as possible. By the same token, we want them to do these programs in a smart way, but ultimately the goal is to get more electric vehicles on the road. So with all of those concerns, why are we supporting these filings? Well, first of all, there is a consumer engagement piece, as you heard, that we think is very important. Things like ride and drive events are the most effective proven way to get more people to realize that electric vehicles are a good option for them and are an option that's available to them. We also think, as noted, that having this backbone of fast charging is critically important, both to allow people who don't have a place to charge at home or who drive more miles or are making longer trips to charge up, but also because of the visibility and the marketing benefit that those highly visible multi-port pods provide. There's also a number of other pilots, as you've heard, with transit and so forth that we think are important. It's worth noting, as came up, not only are we as an association supportive, we've submitted letters on behalf of several of our members, including General Motors, several conservation groups, and a letter signed by 8 competitors of ChargePoint, other EV charging companies, saying that they support this proposal and they do not believe that it's non-competitive. So we have to respectfully agree to disagree. I think we have a couple of members, including ChargePoint, that have concerns about the proposal. They have a couple of members that are charging companies that signed on to our letters. And I think what it comes back to, frankly, is, again, this question of what's best for the entire ecosystem and for accelerating transportation electrification may not be what's best for specific companies within that ecosystem and what their business model looks like. But I think we need to look at the bigger picture here in the longer term. So with that, as I say, we are supporting this proposal and the proposed settlement, and we believe the concerns that we do have will get worked out as we do these pilots and as these rules for long-term plans get developed, and we look forward to working with the PUC and the utilities and the other stakeholders on that process.
Okay, thank you very much, Jeff. Rick Benz, I think we just have time for one question.
I would just like somebody to provide me with perhaps the, Mr. Ross, you could, the studies that show that our infrastructure in pick a block, any block of Salem or Portland, is adequate for, let's say, half of the people in that community to have electric cars. I have this fear that if things turned out the way everybody wants them to, we are suddenly inundated with electric cars, we wouldn't have the infrastructure to deliver the electricity to their houses to charge them up. So I just want to see us, show me that that which is already in place is adequate or not. Just show me the study.
I think I don't have that study that there wouldn't be enough infrastructure to provide. Let me just get it clear that there wouldn't be enough infrastructure to provide electricity to all of the folks in a house if they're all of a sudden there's a boom on electric cars.
Sure. Let's assume that it turns out the way we want, and half the people in one city block in Portland suddenly have electric cars. Mm-hmm. Is the pipeline into their houses adequate?
Well, that would be a study that the utility should perform.
Well, great. The utilities can provide.
Certainly something that they should look at. And one of the things that we're talking about here, though, that's interesting is, to your point, and it's, I think, 80%, maybe I'm wrong, but most people charge, as Chair Dembro mentioned, most people charge their cars at home. And actually, the program that we're talking about here is not necessarily is not a home charging program. It's actually to get people out of charging, make it so that they can charge their car at work, charge their car when they're going shopping, get out and do that, and to expand that range, 250 miles in your Volt, is that, so expand that range. So I think, to your point, to your question, this program that we're talking about actually is to disperse that charging so there isn't an impact on that specific block or that specific area. But, in terms of studies on impact of the grid to users, that's something that utilities do in California, in Massachusetts, in Ohio, Nevada. That's kind of their common bread and butter, and that would be more appropriate to go to that.
Very quickly, Chair Dembro, Chair Hill, Representative Benz, there was a national, I think there's two questions. There was a national study that Electric Power Research Institute did some years ago that said if overnight half the fleet was switched to electric, we would generate enough electricity to cover that, and it wouldn't require any new power plants. So is there electricity there? On the upgrades locally, what I can tell you is that in California, where they have, in specific areas, very high adoption rates, 10, 15% of the fleet already, or 20%, the transmission distribution upgrades have been less than 1% of the regularly scheduled transmission and distribution upgrade investments in those regions. So that we've seen very minimal need for upgrades. And then the last point would be, this is exactly what utilities did when people started buying flat-screen TVs and air conditioners, and I have total confidence that utilities know how to keep those transformers operating so that we don't have brownouts,
Thanks,
but it'd be a good problem to have.
Okay, that's good. Rick Helm.
Thank you. Since we have many of the parties here that are participating in this space, I wanted to give some encouragement, because I think I, like a lot of my colleagues, were really excited about the progress we've made in the last two sessions. Three sessions now, actually, toward encouraging electrification of our grid to support zero emissions vehicles. And our investor-owned utilities do what they do very well, and that is they figure out how to provide the most reliable power for the lowest rate. And when we adopted 1547, we wanted to trigger that and use as a catalyst the ability to rate base charging stations to light a fire. That's what I wanted. And what I worry about now is that we don't know what we don't know. And it is not the investor-owned utility's speciality to figure out the market for how consumers will interact with these new opportunities. And we're not even exploring them adequately, in my view, yet. And I think we need to borrow from other industries to understand what consumer choice might be. So I want to encourage all of you that are in this space right now to think more creatively than you are now, because I think there are massive opportunities in just the times and the places and the ways we get people to charge their vehicles that we haven't thought about yet. And let's get through this little skirmish that we're having right now and get back to thinking about important and creative ways that we can expand this market.
Okay. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Thanks for all who presented on this. Okay, our next topic is one that will make none of us squirm, that actually will make perhaps our eyes glow. And let's call up Senator Johnson, please, to let us know how things are going with the what I consider really a wonderful visionary project, the Salmonberry Trail Project.
Welcome. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I represent Senate District 16, which is the home to the Salmonberry Trail. I'm going to ask you to imagine an Oregon that is the location of a network of interconnected trails accommodating hikers, horses, and bikes, where visitors could have an experiential multi-day or even week visit to some of our most magnificent scenery, an alignment or alignments that connect urban and rural Oregon and traverse territory from the Willamette Valley to the majestic Pacific Ocean. The proposed Salmonberry Trail is Oregon's most ambitious rail-to-trail project. It is 86 acres from Banks in western Washington County to the Oregon coast in Tillamook County. Along the way, the trail takes in farms and valleys, the thickest and the most rugged part of the forested coast range, the meandering Nehalem River Valley, and stunning coastal views as it travels through a rich, both with culture and historical, landscape. I've been a strong proponent of this trail and brought forward legislation in 2014, Senate Bill 1516, that teed up two state agencies that you'll be hearing from this morning. In my view, this trail has the potential to strengthen local economies. I don't know, I didn't look when I came in, whether the city manager from Banks is here. She was going to come. But the little community of Banks is wildly enthusiastic and already doing urban planning to accommodate not only the trailhead, but also they hope the shops and the supply vendors that would cater to folks that could be here for multiple days, both with accommodations and comestibles. This is going to get Oregonians active and outside, learning about our forests, and remind us of our deep history and connection with working landscapes. This idea that is in the best tradition of how Oregon solves problems with not-for-profits, citizens, multiple levels of government, from cities to ports to counties to state agencies, has been percolating for some time. I think we've been doing thoughtful homework. We have had master planning, engineering analysis of bridges and tunnels, hazardous material assessments, economic benefit studies, and multiple outreach to local communities and landowners. The not-for-profit organization that you're going to hear from shortly has been raising funds, more than $2 million to date, to help with this planning and the eventual construction, which we all recognize will happen in phases because of the ambitious scope of this project. The trail doesn't exist yet, although with Willamette Week's help, we've had a number of very ambitious and energetic extreme cyclists already perusing the landscape. But we're doing our work. We're identifying segments where we could begin construction immediately. I know this project is something that you want to hear about, so it's my pleasure to introduce the experts that can handle your questions. Team Salmonberry, that is sitting behind me, they include M.G. Devereaux, Deputy Director of Oregon Parks and Rec, Ross Holloway, the Executive Director of the Tillamook Forest Heritage Trust, his board chair and boss, Nels Gabbert, Dennis Wiley, the Salmonberry Trail Project Manager from Parks, and they will be able to answer your questions and I hope provide a context for an opportunity that all of us should be proud of. This will truly, when you connect it with the other trail segments that are either completed or in the works, will make Northwest Oregon, I think, have a national, if not international, reputation for the user groups that we are attempting to accommodate. So thank you very much, Mr. Chair, for making this opportunity for us to share with the legislature the Salmonberry Trail. Thank you.
Thank you, Senators. Can we get another chair up there, and we can have all four of you at the same time? And while they're doing that, I just want to say what really attracts me to this project is the notion of this trail uniting the metro region with the coastal range region, with the coast. It's really a fantastic thing and something I hope we can all get behind. So who's starting? Okay, great.
Chair Denborough, Chair Helm, members of the committee, for the record, my name is M.G. Devereaux, and I'm proud to be the Deputy Director for the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. I'm representing Lisa Assumption, the director who unfortunately could not be here today, which is the co-chair of the Salmonberry Trail Intergovernmental Agency, which we refer to as STIA, which you'll be hearing a little bit more about in terms of what it is and the partnership that it brings together for the governance of the trail and how it's moving forward to accomplish a vision that was set forward as one of the potential premier outdoor recreation attractions, not only for Oregon visitors, but also for the neighboring communities as well. So for about the next few minutes, you'll hear from a number of folks who are on the project team who bring us together in some very exciting ways. This project, like many that are getting accomplished in Oregon, is defined by its partnerships. It's come together to support a number of different ideals, but also with a common vision of moving forward this notion of a premier recreation environment in one of the most rugged and spectacular landscapes in Oregon that connects the rural communities of the coast to the agriculture communities of the valley and the urban communities of Portland and the surrounding areas around the urban population. We get to connect generations of folks that have used the Tillamook Forest, that have used the coast, that have used the trails that are in and around the Portland metro area, and bring a sense of vitality and resilience to the region that will also, as Senator Johnson indicated, hopefully bring a new sense of economic resilience to those communities. In a few minutes, you'll hear from our project manager, Dennis Wiley, about how our project has moved forward in terms of the history of the rail line and how we have taken this idea, which is still an idea, as Senator Johnson said, to move it to a planning process and a conceptual process. You'll hear from Ross Holloway from the Tillamook Forest Heritage Trust, who will talk about the partners and the governance of the group that make up this exciting process and talk about some early fundraising success. Nels Gabbert, who is the chair of the Tillamook Forest Heritage Trust and an early proponent of the trail, will describe the momentum, maybe some of the challenges, and why the vision is so important for the region and for Oregon. I and the rest of the team want to personally thank Senator Johnson for her leadership and energy on this project. She has invested much of her time, much of her passion into making sure that the concept continues to move forward, that local communities continue to have a voice in how the project is shaped and how it moves forward, and hopefully the expansive vision for making this connection real. As you'll see, the trail does not exist yet, but the possibility that of reclaiming a rail line that has been flooded out through two significant storms is one that is exciting. The potential is there, and the group and a growing partnership are ready and willing to stand to do the homework and to make this project a reality for Oregon and its visitors.
Good morning, committee chairs and members. For the record, I'm Dennis Wiley. I'm the Salmonberry Trail Project Manager for the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. I think it'd be helpful to start by putting the Salmonberry Trail on the map. Here you can see it relative to other places you recognize, including Portland, Astoria, Tillamook and the Coast, the Tillamook State Forest, Highway 6 and 26, and the existing Banks Renonia State Trail, which is a rail trail project and one of Oregon's most popular trails, and one day will connect to the future Salmonberry Trail. The rail line and the surrounding landscape has a rich history and a unique and diverse array of natural resources associated with it. Military engineers and explorers crossed the eastern edge of the trail area while surveying and constructing the first road between the valley and the coast, the Salem-Astoria Military Road, in 1854. Settlers passed this way between the 1860s and the last century, looking for places to homestead, but most were thwarted by thick timber, rainfall, and steep, inaccessible country. Railroad builders moved in, and towns sprang up in the early 1900s. Loggers and sawmills were busy feeding the need for the lumber to build a growing state. Rail cars moved tons of wood, agricultural products, and passengers between Portland and the coast. Construction of a railroad connecting Tillamook to Portland in the Willamette Valley began in 1905 and was finally completed and ready for business in 1911. Its completion changed Tillamook County and the Northwest Oregon for all time. Surrounded by magnificent old-growth forest and no way to get all the lumber to market, for years, railroad companies speculated on how to construct a rail line to open up that country. All of the odds were stacked against the rail builders who opened up the Salmonberry Country in the early 1900s. Heavy rains, high, steep, inaccessible hillsides thick with timber, and an ongoing challenge of finding sufficient workers, supplies, and equipment. The Pacific Railroad and Navigation Company began construction in Hillsboro in 1905 and in Tillamook in 1906. Crews worked toward the middle. In between, 13 tunnels, all dug by hand, horse, and by steam. The longest tunnel was almost 1,500 feet and took 8 months to build. 25,000 cubic yards of earth was hand-loaded, carted, and dumped. 93 bridges, 35 of them over 100 feet long, crossed an abundance of creeks and rivers. The Step Creek Bridge near Timber was reputed to be the highest single-pile bridge in the world. The single piles were almost 100 feet in length. The Big Baldwin Trestle was 167 feet tall and 520 feet long. Much of the construction work was performed by immigrants, Swedes, Austrians, Greeks, Russians, Irish, Norwegians, Japanese, Chinese, all working side by side. By 1907, 40% of all railroad workers in Oregon were Japanese. Railroad right-of-way in the most remote sections were cleared with horses. Then horse-drawn wheeled scrapers plowed down to mineral soil. Later steam donkeys, huge locomotive-sized self-propelled winches, helped with moving logs, sawn timber for trestles and ties and boulders. Crews followed to build and level the railroad grade and make it ready for ties and steel. Even today, the enormity of this effort is hard to imagine. The line soon got a nickname from the railroad employees who worked along its length. The Pacific Railway and Navigation Company, the PRN, became the punk, rotten, and nasty. Landslides and washouts were common, and an engineer never knew what he'd find around the next corner. Over the years, ownership of the line transitioned from the Pacific Railway and Navigation Company to Southern Pacific, and eventually, after major damages in the 1990s, to the Port of Tillamook Bay, which is its current owner. Regardless who owned and maintained it, keeping the line open over the years was a huge task as storms, fires, slides, and heavy winds battered, bent, and washed out the rails. Damage like this happened on a yearly basis. Storms in 1996 severely damaged the line, but it was rebuilt. The storms and floods of 2007, shown here, were different, washing out major bridges, crossings, and whole sections of railbed across 16 miles in the middle of the line in some of the most remote and rugged stretches through the Salmonberry Canyon near the top of the Oregon Coast Range. Here's one of our favorite photos showing the magnitude of the 2007 storm damage. An entire section of rail was wrenched free and driven through the heart of two Douglas fir trees more than 15 feet off the ground. Imagine the power and energy it took to do that. Play that out across the worst 16 miles, and you can understand why, after 2007, the Port of Tillamook Bay decided not to rebuild. The damage and the cost was insurmountable. That's when the notion of the Salmonberry Trail really began. Tillamook County and the Port of Tillamook Bay reached out to state parks and the Department of Forestry, which is the major landowner along the trail, to come together with them to study the possibility of creating a multi-use trail along the footprint of the damaged line. Soon, a coalition formed, which included state parks, ODF, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, Cycle Oregon, Tillamook County, Senator Betsy Johnson, the Governor's Office, and the Northwest Regional Solutions, and many citizens representing surrounding communities and interest groups. A feasibility study was completed in 2013, which involved an analysis to identify issues like ownership, potential maintenance needs, gauging public interest, rough costs, natural and cultural resource issues, recreational potential. Following that, we completed a concept plan that provided a framework for further development of both the trail concept and the organization needed to make it happen. In the spring of 2015, we completed a major concept plan that provided a framework for pursuing the project, including the beginning of design and engineering solutions, a call for significant public involvement, and ideas about how the trail could connect to many different existing trail and transportation networks across the region. The concept plan was endorsed and adopted by the Oregon Parks and Recreation Commission and the Oregon Board of Forestry. The concept plan identified a number of key benefit trail development could bring to local communities, the Northwest Oregon region, and the state as a whole. Chief among these are among the many opportunities for making connections to diverse outdoor resources, including forests, rivers, and beaches, to the diverse working farms and forests that lie adjacent to the trail. From the farms and vineyards of Tualatin Valley to the private and state forests along the Coast Range to the dairy farms of Tillamook County. Along the way, the trail would provide access for hikers, bikers, equestrians, anglers, and hunters. We know that residents of communities with access to trails tend to get out and use them regularly for recreation and fitness, so the benefits accrue not just for the region or the visitors, but also for trail neighbors. An important aspect of the trail will be sharing the many layers of history, the human stories that have shaped the landscape. We envision a network of interpretive signs, educational programs, and digital media to help tell these stories. Because of the storm damage, many areas along the rail bed continue to slide, slough, and erode. An important element of the project as we build the trail will be to stabilize and restore these damaged areas as much as possible. Since then, we've been doing our homework, detailed planning on the specific segments you can see here, and working with adjacent landowners and communities to hear their ideas. As we do more detailed planning in the months ahead and better understand the engineering needs, we'll begin to have a sense of total project cost. We're just now focusing in on the valley segment on the eastern side of the project and hope to have identified costs by next spring. Choices about trail alignment, width and use, as well as structural needs of bridges and tunnels, will all have significant impact on the cost. So as you can see by this image, we're really talking about three trails. The Valley Trail, which we're studying right now, will be similar to what you can find at the Banks Renonia State Trail. Very accessible, going through the pastoral landscapes of Western Washington County and beginning to venture up into the Coast Range. Once up in the Coast Range within the Tillamook State Forest, the trail is going to turn into more of a rugged adventure. We call it an adventure trail. That'll run along two rivers. One, the wild and scenic Salmonberry River, which this legendary steelhead runs, and then down along the pastoral bucolic Nehalem River to the Nehalem Estuary. Then the third trail, we're calling it the Connected Coast. It's about a trail that runs on the coast that connects visitors to the wonderful resources of the coast, but it's also about connecting all those communities that along the coast, having this pedestrian access to link them all. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Ross Holloway, my colleague, who's been with this project from the very beginning, to talk a little bit about how we're organizing this, some of our partnerships, and some of the fundraising to date.
Thank you, Dennis. Good morning, co-chairs, Dembro and Helm, and members of the committee. Again, I'm Ross Holloway, so I serve as the executive director of the Tillamook Forest Heritage Trust, a nonprofit partner for this project. Actually, the trust began as a nonprofit form to raise money to create the Tillamook Forest Center on the Wilson River Highway, which we were successful at and does exist today. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the governance and the organization of the project, how we envision it unfolding over time.
As you can see, it's a big project. It's a long trail, 86 miles. It's going to come together in pieces, we expect, over time. And in fact, we'll talk about how that has already started on one end and how we envision it proceeding. The overall project is probably going to take decades. I think the Banks-Fernonia Trail took about 3 decades to fully implement, and this is even a bigger, more complicated project. So we're describing it in 3 phases. Phase one has largely occurred, as you can see from the timeline there, and that involved the feasibility study that Dennis mentioned, the concept plan, but also involved putting together a more formal governance structure. So the original group that came together to start this project was largely an ad hoc group called the Salmon Berry Coalition, and we saw the need for a more formal governance structure, and so we have been pursuing that. I'll talk a little bit more about what that is in the next slide. The second phase, which is what we're in now, we're calling the planning and preparation phase. A lot of foundational work to be done. Some of it has occurred, still some to come. So some key pieces of that are rail banking, which is a process under the National Recreational Trails Act to secure the corridor for use as a trail over time without allowing it to go into abandonment under federal law. So we're nearing the end of that piece of work right now. Segment master planning, Dennis already alluded to. One is done, the coastal segment. One is underway in the valley with the river canyons still in the future, hopefully starting sometime next year. Part of the challenge of the nonprofit is to expand, to be able to handle the fundraising and development needs, and we're sort of midstream in that process right now, creating a larger organization, a better staffed organization. In the past, the Tillamook Forest Heritage Trust consisted of half of me, basically, or half-time position, and we're moving towards a more robust organization. And then a couple of associated projects to that that are going on is a strategic marketing plan development, which we're actually nearing completion of this month, and a more formal benefits study, which Portland State University, in partnership with OSU and the Forest Service, are conducting for us. And that's underway right now and is going to wrap up near the end of this year. So, of course, the big question is, when do you build trail? When is project implementation? Actually, the city of Tillamook has a project underway. Anybody that's been in Tillamook the last few months will see a major transportation infrastructure project going on at the intersection of Highway 101 and Highway 6. The city of Tillamook incorporated into that project essentially the construction of almost the first mile of this trail from Goodspeed Park in downtown Tillamook, north and west out to Hoquart and Slough Park. So they're actually building that trail in conjunction with that project. So you could say trail construction has begun. I think we expect, more significant scaled up trail construction still to be several years out. Probably a large project on the east side, we're hoping maybe our first kind of catalyst project. So I talked a little bit about the governance, just a real quick overview snapshot. We did form a intergovernmental agency about 2 years ago called the Salmon Berry Trail Intergovernmental Agency. It was formed under ORS 190, so it's a formal organization with an intergovernmental agreement in place. The Salmon Berry Coalition still exists as an advisory body to that. The Tillamook Forest Heritage Trust then is the nonprofit partner that again is basically leading the effort on fundraising and development. And then advisory committees are formed as needed. We've had one for the coastal planning, in the process of forming one to support the valley planning work, and anticipate others as other pieces of the project come into play. These are the member organizations of the Salmon Berry Trail Intergovernmental Agency. So if you will, these are the signatories to that intergovernmental agreement. 4 primary jurisdictional agencies. Of course, the Port of Tillamook Bay owns the rail corridor. Tillamook County and the 2 state agencies have been primary agencies supporting the effort along the way. Also a number of ex officio board members, which includes another nonprofit, the Washington County Visitors Association, who have been significant players in funding and supporting the project. And we'll talk a little bit in a couple slides about where some of the funding has come from, and you'll see that many of these groups have contributed financially to the project.
And Ross, we're going to have to wrap up.
Okay. So a lot of moving parts. operational tasks, fundraising and development tasks are outlined here, and you'll have access to a copy of the presentation. So I won't dwell on that. And then maybe just a quick snapshot of over $2 million in funding to date from a variety of partners, local, state, and federal government, actually, and EPA, as well as a number of private and nonprofit entities. One that's not on here that we just received was a grant from the National Rails to Trails Conservancy funding our benefits study. So I'm going to turn it over to Nels for some closing comments, and we'll wrap up. Senator Dembro, thank you.
Welcome, Nels.
Good morning, Chairs Dembro and Helm, and all the committee members that are here. Thank you for your time. I'm Nels Gabbard. I'm the chair of the Tillamook Heritage Trust, the Tillamook Forest Heritage Trust. I want to close this presentation this morning with some thoughts about our vision and motivation and some of the challenges and opportunities that we see ahead for this project. My intention today and in general with this project is to educate Oregon citizens about this opportunity. And it's because it's a long-term, complex project, it's a long-term, complex conversation. And I welcome the opportunity to share a little bit about what we've been up to with you today. This project, as you've heard, is a project rooted in history, in a working landscape, and in the communities along the line. The trail will connect people to each other, to their heritage and our history, to the natural landscape, to the future, to ideas and insights outside of what they think they know about forests and rivers and railroads and Oregon. It's a legacy project for Northwestern Oregon, but as Senator Johnson said, it's much more. It's an opportunity to develop a project that will have regional significance, national recognition, and I think an international draw. We're known in Oregon for our visionary projects. Here's one that you can see on the right. Is the Banks-Vernonia State Trail just north of Highway 26 near Buxton. And on the left, here's what could be on the footprint of the now disused Port of Tillamook Bay Line, the future Salmonberry Trail. Here's another example. This infrastructure hasn't been maintained for a decade. The rail bed is growing in with alder and Douglas fir. The tunnels, and there are many of them, are crumbling. The rails still have some salvage value, but getting them out of the new jungle that is reclaiming the line makes that less and less feasible each year. Now is the time to begin repurposing this remarkable public resource for its next generation. And I think it's important to note that we don't have endless time to do that, and that's one of our challenges. We have an opportunity that's alive today, and we need to move on it. This linear link connected us in many ways when it was built more than a century ago, and it's ready today to reconnect us and to serve as a gateway for economic development, outdoor recreation, education, and wellness. Public support is there and is contagious. When people hear about this trail or when we take them out to see the old rail bed, they get it and they get excited. Our greatest challenge now is to build the capacity to help project the idea to its next stage of development. And as I said, we're currently building that capacity and the leadership to get others involved. It's our primary challenge in the short term. The light at the end of the tunnel is the future, and we have a ways to go. We have the vision, the community-wide support is growing, and we're actively pursuing the resources to make it a reality. I invite all of you here today, as I have invited many others, to consider what role you can play to support this vision. There's lots of possibilities. We're glad to take any of your questions.
Thank you very much, all of you, and Senator Johnson for leading it off. We don't really have time for questions, but you know, I do want to say that I see this project as comparable to what was done in this state to restore the Tillamook Forest after the burn. It became more than just a project. You know, it became something that brought Oregonians together, and this really seems to be comparable to that, involving people, their recreation. But not only that, an opportunity for them to get in touch with their culture and their history and their pride as Oregonians. So Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Okay, so now, colleagues, we come to our final item, which is the update on this fire season that we are still, unfortunately, in the middle of. And so we have Peter Doherty and Doug Graff will give us an update. Before they begin, colleagues, I want to let you know that in November, at least the Senate committee is going to be devoting the bulk of our hearings to the issue of forests and forestry, looking at doing, you know, by then, hopefully this season will be a couple of months in behind us, we'll be able to do a deep dive into lessons learned from this session, both in our state forests and our federal forests. And we'll also be getting a report from the Global Warming Commission. Some of you saw an editorial that Catherine Mader put in the Oregonian yesterday. We'll get a detailed presentation of that. We're going to be also getting a report on where we are on advanced wood products, which you know, we also see as very kind of key to how we are going to be managing our forests in a productive, sustainable way that really encourages forest health. So that should be very interesting. I know there's also interest among some people here in our forming a work group to really look at forest practices. I'm very much open to that. I've been talking with Representative Clem, who chairs the Ag and Natural Resources Committee, about that. And please, any thoughts you have around that, please do share with me. So, but with that, before you start, of course, I know I'm speaking for everyone here in expressing our deepest appreciation for all of those who are out there fighting these fires, and our thanks that they've been able to do this in relative safety. I mean, the safety concerns have been respected, and I think have gotten good results. So, thank you, both of you.
Thank you. Chairs Dembro and Helms and members of the committees, for the record, I am Peter Doherty, and I serve as the Oregon State Forester and the Director of the Department of Forestry. I'm here with Doug Graff, Chief of Fire Protection, and we'll be providing a very brief update on our fire season. 2017 has been a very challenging fire season for Oregonians. We've had multiple large, uncontained wildfires on the landscape for over a month, creating significant loss for Oregon. Many Oregonians have suffered from hazardous air quality due to smoke. We have lost significant forest resources. We've had highway closures and have spent millions of dollars fighting fires this year. The department has been fully extended fighting this summer's wildfires. Resources have been thin to non-existent throughout the country and here in Oregon. We have been in an all-hands-on-deck mode since the eclipse and the fire season is not over. Oregon's policy is to preserve and conserve forest resources through prevention and suppression of forest fires using a complete and coordinated fire protection system. Our primary mission in fire is protecting forest resources, second only to saving lives. And that system has proved its worth again this fire season. You have witnessed the successes on several high-profile fires, such as the Chetco Bar and the Eagle Creek. As the Chetco Bar raced towards Brooking, growing 44,000 acres in a single day, the Coos Forest Protective Association, in partnership with the landowner community, started building fire lines. They entered a unified command with the state fire marshals and Forest Service, and with the help of many partners, including the National Guard and state police, kept the public safe and prevented that fire from devastating the community. While most of you have heard of the dozen or so large wildfires on the landscape, I want to draw your attention to the 890 fires you have not heard about. You have not heard about these fires because we've caught them at initial or extended attack. Operationally,
We protect resources by providing aggressive, safe initial attack to stop fires at the smallest possible size, minimizing acre burn, suppression cost, and resource loss. So far, we've caught 96% of the fires on our protected lands at 10 acres or less. Our severity resources and our partnership with forest landowners and contractors have been critical to this success. That said, this fire season has reinforced what we already know from the 2016 Secretary of State audit and the 2015 and 16 fire program review. We do not have a sustainable fire organization for these kind of fire seasons. This summer, we've once again had to delay or suspend work in our other divisions as we focused on fires. We were stretched to find resources for our fires and to keep our incident management teams fully staffed. We also need to develop a solution to sustainable large fire funding. And finally, we need to significantly increase the pace and scale of treatments to make Oregon's forests more resilient to fires and examine policies that are slowing this work down. And with that, I'll turn it over to Doug for a quick couple of statistics.
Yeah. Good morning, Representative Helm, Co-Chair Denbro, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Doug Graff. I serve as Chief of Fire Protection in the Oregon Department of Forestry. I do recognize we have 3 minutes here for the close of the committee, and I'll hold to that. And I will not be able to get to the breadth of fire season. Of course, this is really a preliminary report. Anyhow, we are still fighting fire, but I think a few comments would be helpful as we look at this fire season early on. And this is a vision that we've all experienced for much of Oregon. This is September 4th. Of interest for this day, we burned 13,000 acres that day across Oregon and Washington. On the 5th, we had 50,000 acres additional burned from what was on the landscape the previous day. And then on the 6th, 96,000 acres in addition to what was on the previous day. And on the 7th, 69,000 acres. That's the type of landscape, the type of fire conditions we had for much of middle of August through the middle here of September, and I'm very pleased to be here today in this environment with you all today with the rains outside, and of course we'll be available for further conversations in detail in the future. Perhaps one other comment I'll make. There's many key drivers of a fire season, and this slide is very robust, and it details the lightning conditions that we've experienced across the landscape. Last year, 2016 fire season, we had 27 on ODF protected acres. We had 27 lightning caused fire. This year, we're sitting at 275 lightning fires. So lightning was certainly a key driver. But as you look at the August period, when all the lightning fires started, and here's the list of them below that, this followed the heat wave. This is early August conditions. So we've had a heat wave from August 1st through 3rd. We broke record temperatures in Medford, 110 degrees on August 1st, 112 degrees on August 2nd, and 109 degrees on August 3rd. Consistent there was a second heat wave, September 1st and 2nd, 105 and 2 in Medford, and 95 and 98 in Portland. And what followed each of those heat waves was lightning strikes, or in the case of Portland, Eagle Creek fire, human-caused fire. So the conditions were ripe for alignment with lightning-caused fires and the conditions on the landscape. And that set us up for much of August and until this day in September with significant fires on the landscape. To date, we burned within Oregon in totality across all jurisdictions. Close to 678,000 acres burned, $340 million spent on fire suppression, and we've had 1,900 fires across the state of Oregon, across all jurisdictions. With that, I'll close.
Okay. Colleagues, questions? We can take a couple of minutes if you'd like, but actually, you know, what I'm also interested in is either today or in the future, if you could get to me as we are planning for our meeting in November and doing the deep dive and the questions that need to be answered, you know, what your questions are that you'd like the agency to address.
And for the House Committee, I'd invite you to do the same. As we head toward that November hearing, I haven't quite decided whether we'll join the Senate again, but several of the topics around forestry that we wanted to talk about initially, we thought we might talk about today, and then it made sense to postpone those. So I'll be looking for that same sort of input and questions.
Okay. Rep. Marsh had a question, and Senator Johnson, I think, has a question, and Rep. Brocksmith, and we'll end with that. We're not being thrown out of this room. Those of you I know, many of you have other commitments.
Thank you, Chair. I just wonder if you could break down that $340 million figure to describe the sources.
Yeah, I can break it into two sections. So the state's responsibility in that, through the department, where we protect 16 million acres of forest land in the state, our gross cost of $37 million. Our net cost after FEMA recoveries and recoveries from other agency billings is at $31.5 million in the state. And for the acres burned, of the 670-plus thousand acres burned in the state, ODF protection, we have 42,000 acres burned on ODF protection.
So the balance of roughly $310 million is federal, all federal. Different sources at the federal
exactly.
level.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And colleagues, you know, one thing I didn't mention, and Doug referred to the, what was it called, that task force, the fire program reviews that several of us sat on that. We'll make the report available to everyone, which looked into, you know, as Peter mentioned, the real challenges the department has where all hands need to be on deck during the fire season. And so all the other work having to do with prevention and et cetera can't be done then. Sorry. Senator Johnson.
Thank you. Mr. Graff just made my point that of these 678,000 acres, only 42 are within the agency's purview. So I think this speaks very strongly to bad federal practice.
Right.
And with no disrespect, Mr. Chair, some of us are so concerned about this that we're going to begin fire discussions earlier about types of aircraft, about federal policy. And I just want to put it in perspective. In the 20 years from 1933 to 1951 that were the four fires that comprised the Tillamook burn, 20 years, we burned 754,000 acres. We are very close to approaching that. And in 1933, the biggest of the fires, 350,000, no air tankers, no helicopters, no forward-looking infrared. Something is severely broken in federal policy. So several of us are going to start the discussion sooner than November.
Comment?
I'd suggest you involve your federal partners as well. Yes.
I just comment. I just want to bring attention that ODF protects about the same amount of acres in Oregon as the U.S. Forest Service. They're at, what, 600 and some thousand acres, and you guys are at 40. Significant difference in agencies.
Rep. Brocksmith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Peter, thank you so much for all your diligence during this fire season. As someone who's been involved with the Chetco Bar and in some of your comments, Senator, with the biscuit 15 years ago, the start of the day after the Chetco started, you put that together with the silver 15 years before that, you're looking at over 800,000 acres. You're just in that area alone. I'm disappointed, Senator, because as Senator said, you know, this is a very serious problem, and yet we threw it at the bottom of the agenda with very little time. And
nobody's sitting on the committee.
Yeah, and it's and they had other commitments.
And I was clear in my letter to the representative Clem that I would like to see, since the House Ag and Natural Resources Committee clearly deals with all forestry management and not the House Energy and Environment, that those joint meetings be with the House Ag and Nat and those hearings in November. The Senator Johnson's exactly correct. Fire policy is broken. And I am refreshed by Director Doherty's comments towards the close of his presentation. And I appreciate them very much. And I appreciate all your work, as we've been on the phone quite a bit over these last nights. And I look forward to having the conversation some more because, you know, I have, we all do in Southern Oregon. You know, I was in your district yesterday. You know, if we want to talk about air quality, and we have new research showing how horrible wildfire and the air quality from wildfire is over diesel emissions and so forth. We have a long conversation ahead before we start looking at other policy that was in the beginning of this presentation for this committee. So thank you, Senator.
Thank you. And, you know, one thing I just want to say is that, you know, I think it's really important for us to not look at any of the contributing factors to these fires as either or kinds of things. You know, I think we're looking at an accumulation of contributing causes, you know, and I would say, you know, since you referred to diesel, you know, the fact that this is a problem, that is pollution from forest fires, does not, should not minimize at all the impact of, you know, diesel emissions, certainly on people who live in the areas who have compromised breathing. That's what it's like for them every day. I know, just speaking for myself, I really developed a lot of sympathy for them, given the last couple of weeks in Portland. Some of those days were just really hard to breathe. And, you know, this is an issue that we need to look at really with clear eyes and ideally, you know, put our own personal agendas in check and just look at all the contributing factors. So,
and Senator, I appreciate, yes, those comments as well. Because I agree with you, we do need to put our agendas aside. My philosophy is very simple. If this legislative body is going to be having control over human-made, you know, man-made pollutants, right, then we have the ability to mitigate, we need to also hold true that we have the ability to, again, mitigate that of forest fires, because we can control that as well to a point. And so I thank you for those comments.
Once again, we agree, Representative. Mm-hmm. And on that note, thank you very much, Doug and Peter. And again, please give our best to those on the lines.
Thank you.
With that, I'm going to close this meeting of the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee, and I've been authorized to close the House Committee as well. We are adjourned. We are adjourned.